So this story of the Transfiguration is familiar. Most of us, I think, have heard it before. It always happens on the last day of Epiphany before we go into Lent, this 40 days of fasting that happens prior to Holy Week. But there's context to this story, and context matters. And so I think it's important that we familiarize ourselves with the context. The Transfiguration happens in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and in all of them, they have the same context right before. And it begins with Jesus taking his disciples to Caesarea Philippi, and he asks them, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And some of them say, "Well, Moses, or Elijah, and John the Baptist," or others, "Jeremiah." And Jesus says, "Well, who do you say I am?" And Peter says, "You are the Anointed One," which is Christ, actually. That's what it means, Anointed One. You are the Anointed One, the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says to him, "Blessed are you, for flesh and blood has not revealed this, but my Father in heaven. You are Peter, you are a rock, and I will build my church on this." And then he sternly orders his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. So that happens. And then he begins to teach his disciples to show them that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great sufferings at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed on the third day and be raised. So he starts teaching them that the way ahead is one of suffering. And Peter says to him, and begins to rebuke him. He takes him aside and begins to rebuke him and says, "God forbid it, Lord. This must never happen to you." So Peter doesn't want to hear about the suffering, or he doesn't think that it's possible that the way of suffering should be the way. And Jesus turns to Peter and says, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance, you are a block to me, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." And then Jesus tells his disciples, "If any wish to come after me, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit them if they gain the whole world but forfeit their life? Or what will they give in return for their life? If any wish to come after me, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me." That's the context. And then our text says 6 days later, 6 days after this, right? Which seems reminiscent of that Exodus text where Moses is in the cloud for 6 days and then he goes up to the top of the mountain. And that's what happens in our story, is that 6 days later, Jesus takes Peter and James and John and he brings them to the top of the mountain, because often at the top of the mountains in human experience is where we encounter the divine. And that often happens in human experience. And so Moses had an experience of God on the top of the mountain, which is what our Old Testament text was. Elijah has an experience of God on the top of a mountain, right? If you ever climbed to the top of a mountain and looked out upon the view and had that sense of awe, you get it. There is something that happens to your soul. But these folks go to the top of the mountain, and the story is that Jesus somehow was filled with this incredible light, such that it was blinding and it was white, and that is symbolic of being in the presence of the divine. And so there's somehow, some way where Jesus is there with the presence of divine, and the divine is shining through him, and there is Moses and Elijah, who too have had been in the experience of the divine, and the disciples are there, and Peter's overwhelmed, and he's like, We should build some booths. We should build some tents and stay here, and commemorate this in some way. And then they hear this voice: "This is my Son, the beloved, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." And at the sound of the voice, the disciples collapse to the ground in fear, and they're terrified. Which also often happens in the presence of the divine. People are aware of their own mortality. aware of how small they are in comparison. They're afraid of being overwhelmed by the power and presence. And so all of that disappears. Moses and Elijah disappear, and Jesus comes over to the disciples cowering on the ground, and he reaches out and he puts his hand on them. He says, "Do not be afraid." And they get up and they go down the mountain and begin their journey towards Jerusalem. And they're not ready for that journey towards Jerusalem. They're not ready for what's going to happen, you know, at the end of that journey. But they go anyway, and they enter in. And part of the story of that journey is Jesus again will climb another mountain, except this time he actually won't climb it. I mean, he climbs it, but that mountain is Golgotha. And this time on the mountain, there's a cross. And it's in that cross that somehow Jesus enters into the pain and suffering of all humanity, that somehow God enters into the pain and suffering of all humanity. And so that's where this story ends. I mean, Jesus is foretelling that moment right before the transfiguration. That's where it culminates, or that's the penultimate moment, is the cross that then becomes Easter. And it's this trajectory. I mean, this is in many ways why I'm a Christian, is because we have Good Friday and we have Easter, and that's central to our story of the telling of who God is and what God is up to, that somehow God takes the suffering of our humanity so seriously as to enter into it in order to transform it and redeem it and to bring about life, to bring about new possibility, to bring about some sort of hope. That's the Christian telling of things. And that's the template for a Christ-like life. And so you have Jesus saying, hey, if you want to follow me, take up your cross. Or take a cross seriously. I've been thinking about this because we're standing on the cusp of Lent, which is historically in the time of church, a time of fasting, a time of self-denial, a time of some sort of renunciation as a way, as a spiritual practice and as a spiritual discipline. I know many of you grew up Catholic, and if you grew up Catholic, you probably have childhood memories of being forced to fast. Bring those stories to mind. I think the Episcopal Church, in reaction to that, said, well, we're not going to force people to fast. We don't want to put them in a sense of obligation and duty around this, because that actually, whenever obligation and duty is entering into your spirituality, it tends to corrupt and corrode grace. And so there was this pulling away from obligation and duty, and you know, we instead about fasting, we talked about feasting, and we talked about, you know, instead of a suffering, we talked about the wilderness and all those kinds of things. And for those of us who live very comfortable lives, that was very helpful, or not helpful, but we liked it, we resonated it. Because if you're living a comfortable life, you don't want to be discomforted. And we live very privileged lives here. All of us here in this room live very privileged lives. I haven't thought much about this and about Lent. And, you know, for Lent, what are you going to, I mean, if you give up anything, you give up chocolate. Which is how we've done Lent. Coming at this differently, our bishop has actually called the church to fast this Lent. And part of his reasoning, there was a document by Sam Torvaldsen that he's been circulating, that actually is trying to reconnect us with why fasting matters, with why fasting took place in the Christian church and in the early Christian community. That fasting actually historically and biblically happens in when trauma has been experienced or where there's some sort of social crisis. Like when somebody has experienced trauma and there's been deep harm that has been done to them, sometimes in the Bible, they will fast and they will don sackcloth and ashes as partially as a way of reclaiming their own agency. When they have been hurt and victimized by some sort of traumatic element outside of them, they choose to fast as a protest, as a way of marking and proclaiming their grief and their suffering and making it real, but being empowered in the midst of their suffering, which is part of the healing process when you've experienced trauma. Right? So that's one element of fasting, that sometimes people fast because they've experienced trauma, and it's about them being able to show their own agency in the midst of their suffering and to make their suffering real, and it's part of the grieving that needs to happen. Sometimes that impulse to be able to do that also then manifests in times of national crisis. There are times in national crisis in the history of the people of Israel where the people came together to fast. And they did so because they were in a crisis. It was serious. Their national well-being was at stake. And so they came together and they fasted as a form of prayer, as a form of focusing and grounding themselves. Like, rather than being focused on the satiation and comfort, they're choosing to give up. They're choosing not to satisfy themselves. They're choosing to bear hunger as a way of grounding themselves and taking seriously what's happening in the moment of their national life together. I think it's for that reason that the bishop has been calling the church to fast, that we're in a moment of collective seriousness. That it would be good for us to pray, that it may be benefit us and benefit the communities we're a part of to be grounding ourselves in such a way that we're forced, rather than to focus on what we're taking in, that we're focused on prayer instead. That out of our hunger, we cry out. That out of our own suffering, we align with and are sympathetic to and empathetic to the suffering of others, which is not just unique to us. The suffering of Gaza still exists and is profound. People of Ukraine are still in war. The people of South Sudan are in tremendous crisis. I mean, there's great suffering in the world, and there's great suffering on the part of our fellow human beings, brothers and sisters. There's great suffering of people here in the United States who are being denied due process. Right? It's a time of crisis in many ways. And it always has been. And we are often insulated by it because of our social and economic location. And so the practice of the church has been, I mean, during this period and something like this land is, I mean, its biblical roots of fasting are enter into that renunciation, enter into that self-denial, take up your cross and follow Jesus, because that actually is the way towards life. That actually is the way towards renewal. It is the way towards new hope and new possibility. I personally heard that message, and I'm like, that actually I feel convicted by it, personally. That actually, this is a moment where, I mean, I'd rather not fast. I would rather just deny that things are in crisis and pretend that things are okay. But maybe it would be good for my soul to actually pay attention in a way that is empowering. This is something I can do. I'm powerless to change what's happening the suffering of the world larger. I'm powerless to help what's happening in South Sudan. I'm powerless to help what's happening in Yemen. I'm powerless to help what's happening in Gaza. I'm powerless to help do anything about what's happening in Minnesota. But I can start with my own soul. And I can take more seriously my own posture of prayer. And I can cry out more deeply for God's grace and mercy in this world. And I can long more deeply for my own transformation. That's what Lent is. It's an opportunity collectively where we get to step in and do it. Shake up our normal rhythms and routines and do something more profoundly different in this world that is profoundly countercultural. We live in a media and advertising environment where every message is indulge. Indulge, buy, get something new, play. And you don't get the message. Actually, maybe some self-denial might be in your own benefit. So I don't know what that looks like for you. I don't know what that looks like for me. I'm curious if there are those, if you've had experiences of fasting. I mean, how many of you have had experiences of fasting? I don't know if there's some of us. I don't know if anybody would be willing to share some of your experience of fasting. Like, I know, I tried it once when I was in college. I was, like, very earnest and eager, and people told me this was a good thing to do. And so I went for a day without food, and my blood sugar dropped so low that I got so massively depressed. I was just, like, on the verge of death's dark door. And I was like, I'm never going to do that again. Until I had a colonoscopy. And you have to fast, and then I did a juice fast. I realized, oh, you can take in calories, and, you know. And I was surprised at my mental clarity, actually, by doing that. I was like, huh, maybe this isn't so bad after all. Maybe there is some benefit to this. I'd be curious if, can I have the mic, if anybody would just willing to share their experience of fasting, or what they did, and what that was like for them. I'm aware that the people of...
I have a mic.
You got a mic. All right, there you go.
I think I've got one. I worked at a job where I breathed a lot of fumes from printmaking sportswear. I was a layout artist, freshly out of graduate school. This is a day job. And I became so ill from the fumes that I lost weight and I couldn't stop. Parts of my head were swollen. Nobody knew about it. Was before we acknowledged that you could get sick at work under those circumstances. And so I had to seek out the help of a special doctor who put me on an extremely limited diet with massive amounts of fresh juice and vitamins, and I survived.
There's something cleansing about it for you, yeah. Other experiences, John?
Let's see, last July I was in the Amazon and fasted for a week during a ceremony, and I found that as my consciousness sort of dimmed, the dreams of the night began to infiltrate the day. And there was a sense of grace that descended, along with a great sense of powerlessness and vulnerability. And it was a little bit, there was discomfort, but there was also a strange bliss. I can't begin to explain it.
Others, anybody else? Want to share an experience of fasting? Doesn't have to be as wild as this.
I want the second, the,
the fact that you that it changes your consciousness, that it's true, that is a real thing.
Gotcha. Yeah. Anybody else?
I also was profoundly religious when I was in college, and so we were reading all about Matthew and do not fast in public, you want to fast in private, and all of that. And so I also determined to go on, I don't remember if it was Ash Wednesday or if it was Good Friday, but the fast. And it coincided with me catching the flu. And so I went all the day, and then I was violently sick, and it was just not anything I ever wanted to repeat again. So any kind of fasting that I've done has been more juice or lightweight, but just in my brain rather than giving up food.
Yeah, I think so. This is obviously not new to everybody. I mean, lots of people have experiences of it. Muslims fast. I mean, part of what it looks like in Islam, and part of the reason why Muslims fast is because Christians used to fast for 40 days. And some Muslims are like, that's a great idea. You Christians are like doing this. And so that's part of the reason why Islam fasts is for 40 days and 40 nights, because Christians used to during Lent. And then we stopped. But what they do is, I mean, you know, it's a fast from sunrise to sunset. And so you can eat, you know, early in the morning, and you can eat late at night. But during the day, you fast. I think part of the reason why the bishop is calling us to this is not just for our own personal benefit at this time. It's actually we're doing it as people who care about the world. It's we're doing it as people who are concerned about the suffering in the world. We're doing it as people, this isn't just about us and our own personal well-being, which a fast can be, you know, very cleansing and healing. But we're doing it because we're concerned and we care about our neighbor, and we're longing for a spiritual deepening and grounding that will actually help us in this moment in our lives together. So I think that's part of the reason why the bishop is calling us to do that. Jen, sounds like you have something to say. Can I? Sure. Yeah, there's I can do that. Yeah. Put it on the website, I think. Yeah, that's good. So I don't, you know, what the bishop is inviting the clergy to do is to fast during the day, basically, not to have lunch. And so, I mean, I think that's what I'm going to do and experiment with. And, you know, I don't know what that looks like for other people. Can I have the mic again? But
if we fast, we can take the food we might have eaten, whatever it might be, and give it to the food bank.
Yeah, so there's an option, right? I mean, there's a way of putting this into action in some meaningful way. For me, this is an experiment. I'm not an expert at this. I've not done this before. And so I don't know what this looks like, right, for everybody. I can't determine what this looks like for you. But what I am hearing is there is an invitation to take Lent seriously. Like, there's an invitation here to shake up your life and discomfort yourself for the benefit of the world. Well, for your benefit, and then because you are an important part of this world. For your benefit, because you're an important part of the church, and the church is called to minister to the good of the world. For the benefit of this time of crisis, this time of suffering, which is actually not new. Human life has been full of suffering all the time, which is why the church often did this, but we happen to be particularly aware of it in this moment. And so the invitation is to take Lent seriously. Figure out what that means for you. Take up your cross and follow Jesus. Amen.